You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name's Sue Nelson and this is the Food Talk Show, and I'm here as usual with my beautiful boys. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, really. My beautiful boys, so we have Guy Routledge of The Food Rush here.
Good afternoon, Sue.
Yes, hi there. And the lovely Ollie Lloyd from The Great British Chefs.
I have never been described as one of the beautiful boys. But
have
you
not?
Nor have I, actually.
Sounds something out of Peter Pan, isn't it? What's the Peter Pan? Oh, no, whatever.
That's The Lost Boys,
Oh, The Lost Boys. Oh, that's probably what I'm thinking. You are The Lost Boys. You've been found. So we have some lovely guests today. First of all, we have Nick Caution and Lee Caulfield. Lee's actually in the studio with us today. Hi, Lee.
Hey, how are you?
And you do ice cream, so we can't wait to get on to that.
We've got something to taste today, which is excellent. We felt a little bit cheated last week, if we're being brutally honest.
We did feel cheated because nobody brought any food with them, but it's great because Lee has, and it's baking hot in this studio, so can't wait to get the ice cream out. We also have with us two founders, I guess you would say, from Curbstop. So we have Leon and Nick, and you're both on separate lines, so this should be quite interesting technically. So can you both say hi?
Hi there.
Hi. Which one's that? Is that Leon?
That was Nick.
Oh,
was
hello, Nick. Hi, Nick. Okay, so we're all in the studio. And is Leon there too?
Yeah, hi. Nick
great.
Sounds a lot more positive than me.
He does. He sounds quite bullish, doesn't
they both
he?
They sound the same. How are we going to know who's talking about what?
Yeah. So you two have started Curbstop, and I think you've recently gone live with your app. And it's specifically to order street food. Now, I know this sounds a stupid question, but can you, I'm going to ask you first, Nick, can you tell me what street food actually is in your head? Because that's been bandied about, this term, quite a bit recently.
Yeah, it's a broad term, and I think a lot of fixed abode or bricks and mortar businesses have recognised it's a buzzword or a buzz phrase associated with cool and edgy food. So you find a lot of businesses have a street food menu, but they might not be mobile. What we're talking about, Curbstop, is very much a business that has a mobile footprint. It's either going to be in a semi-permanent location, or periodically semi-permanent location, or will just pop up on a beachfront or a roadside and trade from a gazebo or some kind of converted vehicle.
So what you're saying is it's the type of business, not the sort of food that they sell. It's the type of business.
That's right, yeah. So generically, a Curbstop street food vendor would be a mobile street food business. They won't be in the app unless they're serving great food.
Okay, so just asking Leon now. Leon, what is the app itself? Is it a bit like, this sounds probably wrong, really, a bit like Just Eat, where in essence you're ordering food. It's just that you're making sure the food people are ordering are from street food vendors.
That's right, yeah. It's very similar to Just Eat. It's giving really the street vendors the same technology as the large chains now incorporate to drive order ahead. And give the little man really on the street the same technology benefits as the big players get, so they can play on a level playing field.
And is it delivered, or is it something that people order in advance and then have to go and get themselves, so they still get that street food experience? How does that work?
Yeah, so it's still the street food experience. So it's an order and pickup service that we're running at the moment.
Mm. And do you have plans to expand out into delivery, or do you feel like that experience is so important and you wouldn't want to move away from that?
Yeah, no,
we've got a debate going on internally about it, and the foodies would argue very strongly that quality street food, and remember, a lot of these guys that are cooking this are Michelin star chefs who've decided to start up their own business and climb out of the kitchen and build a van that does everything just as well as they've been doing for years in great restaurants, but delivering it to the customer directly. We don't think a quality street food offer is transportable. I mean, you need to be there, see the finishing touches, and collect it, having prepaid for it in the app.
So,
but most importantly, discovered stuff that you've never even known was out there on the street, and ordered it in advance. But we really don't think you can then take that product, shove it in a container, and bike it across London, you know, for 20 minutes. I just don't think it's that kind of food.
We're joined here by Ollie Lloyd, and Ollie runs Great British Chefs and has done quite a lot of research on the foodie, sort of, you know, what that person is and what they do. Ollie, what's your observations of street food and also the things that Leon and Nick are trying to do?
I think what's interesting is that if you look at the foodie, they're actually not that into takeaway. So the last big survey we did on foodies, which is about 5,000 people who agree with the statement, I am a foodie, 66% of people, when looking for a quick dish, would never go to takeaway. And I think that's partially because consistently takeaway's quality is varied and it's quite expensive. Yeah. I think what the street food world has done, certainly from a European perspective, is I think actually allow a much more diverse offering of food. So I don't necessarily think it's competing with restaurants. I think what they're doing is they're creating much more kind of nuanced cuisine and much more sort of specialist producers who will focus on maybe one or two dishes and create something really amazing. And I think it does lean towards the trend of a much more social eating experience.
Mm. Nick, is that what you're finding? You know, is that why you did the app?
The app was developed purely out of frustration, and frankly, the founders were driving their kids up the M6 and routinely spending lots of money on awful food. And it was really around trying to find and enable people who create fantastic food to have a vehicle to actually sell it, publicize it and sell it. So the utopian ideal of it is utopian at this point, but you could set up shop anywhere near a main route, publish your menu and take orders. As long as you've got permission from the local authority or the landowner, you can see a scenario where you've got really good food, you know, in places you just wouldn't expect to have access to it. That was where the idea came from. The technology enables it. So what you've got with Curbstop now is a platform. I don't like to draw parallels with, you know, there are plenty of internet marketplaces out there that you know well. This is a platform that exists, is powered by the Altane platform, which Leon can talk about in spades. But essentially, you know, you can onboard or publish menus in it, and then consumers can view those and order from it. So it's there. It's been built purely to solve a problem, which is finding good food and becoming very frustrated by not being able to find it.
And this isn't not about fast food at all, is it?
Not in the least.
No, I mean, we've got some stats here that says that 57% of Brits would choose McDonald's as one of their go-to fast food chain, which makes me want to weep. Followed by KFC at 42% and Subway at 25%. I mean, it's just, you know, these are people who, I mean, I would never go to any of these because I hate the way they operate. I hate the way that they source their food and all that sort of stuff. And what you're trying to do is, I suppose, give people who, like me, wouldn't go ever to those places because of the way they operate, you're trying to give them more of a choice that they can actually have. So, some sort of takeaway or whatever it is. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all about footprint and, estate and access. And, you know, those brands you've mentioned have been spent a lot of money very successfully rolling out nationwide chains and they're everywhere. So, this concept is again, to the utopian point, it's about, to Leon's point earlier, it's about putting that kind of access and access to consumers and to the technology that the big boys have got in the hands of these small independent businesses that need to have a signpost somehow to say, look, we're here, we're open for business. This is all the great stuff you can eat when you order from us. And to trust in an app that actually has integrity and curate the content so that you've got, you know, traders in there that are only doing great stuff and serving everything from vegan through to, you know, pulled pork, but offering real variety and the kind of range of diets that people are demanding. So that sounds like a bit of a marketing
puff. Indeed.
Ollie, we're passionate about it.
Ollie, you're going to come up with some stats here,
well,
aren't you?
I think the complexity of the whole McDonald's world is, I think, you know, when we try and segment the UK, for us it's a rule of thirds, which is a third of the UK really cares about food. I mean, really cares about food. And they're two thirds that kind of like, well, one third is like, meh, another third is like actively not caring. And the McDonald's lot is the actively not caring. The third, I think, that you know, this app is really targeting is the rest of the UK. And, you know, there's some amazing statistics out there, like, you know, 51% of Brits enjoy talking about food. So if you can give them a product offering which actually allows them access to a unique food experience, which they can go, hey, I was going up the M6 the other day and I discovered this amazing pulled pork gig. Nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's the kind of thing you would tell your friends about. And I think what's clever is that, you know, the technology is available nowadays to make this kind of stuff happen.
You've got some stats as well, haven't you, about Street Food Guy?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the research that we did, which we put together for the show, is, you know, some of the expansion of this kind of market area. And we say something now that in the UK, the fast food revenue is valued around 18 billion, but the street food side of things, where is my notes here?
$2.5 billion.
Yeah, 2.5 billion people each day are consuming street food. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. But this is around the world, not just here in the UK.
Yeah. And also I've got here that according to research, street food consumers in the UK, their top three cuisine types is first Mexican, which I think is quite interesting, and then second Chinese and third Thai. And by Chinese, we don't mean Chinese takeaway. We mean people, you know, cooking fresh and all that in terms of street food. Does that align to some of the stuff you find in foodies, Mexican very high up on the list?
I think certainly from the data I've heard that in terms of takeaway type stuff, it leans much more towards Chinese and Indian.
Okay.
But I think certainly, you know, because a lot more of this is street food stuff is more metropolitan based, it doesn't surprise me that Mexican is leading the way, and it's a cuisine that works very well like that.
Mm.
I mean, what have you guys found on the app? Have you found, is there a particular prevalence of a particular cuisine or
yeah.
not?
Leon?
It's probably more of a question for Nick, actually, because he's
all
the
right.
one that's
Nick.
On boarding.
He's eating around the country.
I was going to say, yeah.
No, Mexican's definitely up there. There's a number of Mexican specialists that have registered, and they're, you know, some of those are vegan and Mexican specialists. There's a whole range: Spanish, Brazilian, and there's a real sort of Venezuelan,
Venezuelan, really?
Yeah.
Venezuelan. Wow.
This is the one thing when you guys were talking about, you know, the kind of people who are doing street food. Is you sort of said, well, you know, Michelin star chef things. I actually think that's not the really interesting part of street food. I think the really interesting part of street food is actually cuisines that it's very, very hard to get hold of in major restaurants. Actually, people saying, you know what, I'm going to cook my home-cooked food, and here are three dishes. And I think that's what makes the street food revolution so interesting, is you're actually getting really indigenous cuisine, not fine dining gone curbside. And that's, for me, the exciting, as a consumer, that for me is the exciting part of it.
The thing that I love about it is that you get these places popping up, and they're so nimble. I mean, they're like the physical equivalent of a modern tech startup, where you're going to throw a team together, you make something really fast, you throw it out there, see what the response is like. And that idea of being able to, you know, iterate on a product or a range of products it makes some really exciting food. But I guess that must also have a few issues for an app like this, because it's a very kind of transient, not population, but, you know, people are moving around a lot, and therefore the client base may find it difficult to engage. What are some of the things that you guys have been doing to help mitigate that?
Well, I'm not going to slope your shoulders and pass it to you, Leon, but this is really around location based, but also switching on and off the menu. It's completely web based. So these settings that are controlled by the trader. They can turn on their menu where and when they want to be trading from.
So if they're not in location, you wouldn't know that they were occasionally there?
Yeah, you wouldn't leave them in the app. Yeah, so essentially they have full control of, you know, their opening times. So when you see the vendor or the trader within the app, it's completely dependent on when they want to open it and when they want to close it.
So it sounds like a really positive tool for these vendors then. So, I mean, I guess it's benefiting the consumer because they can go and discover and find all this really interesting food. But it seems like you're putting a lot of work into helping the vendors run their business better and reach more people and increase their sales even.
For sure. And, you know, we've been working in this space with our model for probably about 12 years. And we do run some of the biggest brands in the country, if not the world. And we found that using this technology, which these guys will be able to benefit from, is that, you know, if you look at your average walk-in order into a fast takeaway shop compared to an order via an iPhone or an Android, you're normally seeing at least 35 to 40% uplift in terms of the purchase price compared to an average walk-in customer. And that's because the consumer has time to view the menu. They're not feeling rushed. The app gives offerings in terms of what they can have with their orders. So it's almost like they have a personal conversation within the app before they order, which is sometimes people don't have that time when they're serving food to the masses.
That's really interesting. And is that an automated thing, like a chatbot, or is that they're having a real conversation with a real person?
No, it's not a real chat, but it's just the flow of how the ordering system works. So, you know, you might say, I'm going to have a wrap, and then it might offer a drink to go with that wrap. So it's subtle, I suppose you would say, upselling to a certain degree. But it's doing the stuff that, you know, when people are living it day to day and are in the thick of it, don't have time to ask those kind of questions. And that's what the app always allows you to do.
And people can find out more about it by going to curbstop.com. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to have a good old look at that, actually. I presume you're just rolling it out in as many cities as you can. I know it's in London already, but also looking at Brighton, Cambridge, Oxford, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Wish you all the luck with it.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's brilliant. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Cheers now. Guy, you know that the sort of street vendor thing, it is quite dynamic, isn't it? And certainly, I don't know if you've been to the wonderful Croydon place.
The wonderful Croydon place? No, I've heard a lot about it, actually.
You've got huge amounts, and they're trying to regenerate and make Croydon into a sort of bit of a tech city. And they know they have to do that with food, combined with food, because it's not going to take off unless you do.
Absolutely,
So they're really trying to attract food stalls and food vendors and whatever, because that's seen as part of the way that you can regenerate somewhere.
Well, it feels like a very modern approach to eating as well. I mean, some of the research that we've been doing into like the younger foodies is that they really enjoy that collaborative kind of eating. You know, they like to get around a big group table rather than just sit in ones and twos. And that was something that we talked about last week with the Spanish tapas and stuff. You can often get that kind of experience with street food because you can go to a handful of different stalls and get one dish in every place, put it all in the middle of the table and get everyone to dig in.
I mean, that's good for families as well, isn't it? Because, like mum wants this, but, you know, you've got a vegan daughter and you've got, you know, it means you can actually sit around one table and people go and get all the different things that they want.
Yeah, and I go to quite a few of the different street food venues around London. Street Feast is one of the big ones, of course. And then there's the Croydon one, which I haven't visited yet.
It's just Box Park.
Box Park in Shoreditch as well.
Box Park is in Shoreditch.
In Croydon,
And I think they try to attract Box Park, you know, deliberately in order to, and it's right outside the station as well, to try and give it that buzz and try and generate that community.
I'm sure it's no coincidence that, you know, Box Park in Shoreditch, which is also like a big tech hub, they've done it, going to do a very similar thing down in Croydon to attract the similar kind of people, I guess. So it makes a lot of sense.
Thoughts on
I still have a yearning for sort of Asian hawker markets, because for me, you know, there is, you know, look, I think the street food revolution in the UK is, it's very, you know, it tries to be quite polished. And I think at times there are a certain number of people who I would say are sort of slightly gaming the show and are sort of, you know, they claim to know what they're doing, but you often sort of do get food that's of mixed quality. Whereas I think I don't think we yet have the authenticity in some ways that you get when you go to the big hawker markets in the Singapores or the Bangkoks, there's just something amazing about it. You have tables everywhere and you just wander between stalls. And I like it when that really it works. For me, one of the main problems often is there isn't the seating. That whole description of
I'll tell you what, Camden Market is the worst for that. So you go to Camden Market, it is packed there.
Yeah.
You've got too many street vendors, supposedly in inverted commas street vendors there. You cannot sit down anywhere to eat. Yeah. And you know, what you're supposed to do, stand up and eat that stuff, that's not what it's about for me. And the Camden Market food stuff just doesn't work, I don't think.
But I think that's
part of it's for tourists.
Well, indeed. But I think that's part of the problem is you do need the infrastructure there for the vendors to make sure, you know, you've got the water, you've got the abilities to kind of do rubbish disposal, like simplistic stuff. But also for the consumers that you can actually sit down and enjoy and eat, because most of the time you rarely do get a table. What you end up doing is sort of walking around and sort of grazing.
Not nice,
but
though,
it's not
it?
As nice. No. And that's why I do think the Asian street markets are amazing when you get those kind of big open courtyards. They have the weather for it, and you sit there and you shop around.
Have you been to Mercato Metropolitano, just Elephant and Castle?
No, I've been meaning to. None of my team.
There's a lot of seating there, actually.
There's not actually street vendors as such because they're fixed, but people, you know, a very small, you know, sort of people who are producing food, you know, very in a very, very small way. You'll get a guy who's just selling mozzarella and a guy who's just got a pizza oven and, you know, all that sort of stuff. What I really like there is there's loads and loads of seating. Mm. And actually what they're finding at Mercato, which I think is interesting, is that they're finding local people are coming to eat there now.
Mm,
and they're eating two or three times a week there.
Brilliant.
And seeing it's a place. And it's starting to get the great atmosphere because it isn't this place where you go and like Disney food, you know what I mean? It's not a Disney destination where you go, a bit like you do in Camden Market really, because just want to go and have a look around in a sort of touristy way. This is beginning to be somewhere where local people eat, and that's the future of street food, isn't it?
But I'm going to be a bit harsh here. I think often a lot of this stuff has been closely tied to property development.
Yeah.
And I think there's that danger that, rather like when a new developer says, hey, I'm going to redevelop this area, and they paint pictures of pretty trees that are going to be there that actually never end up there. They sort of say, I'm going to do a street market and we're going to sort of stick it in this corner. But actually, it's not really thought through. They don't give it the space. They don't actually try and work out how it's going to work. And I think that, you know, if they're not careful in this area, it's going to fail to deliver.
But that's where Mercato have got it right for me, because they've actually started from incentivizing, and they're all Italian, mostly Italian producers, made it very, very Italian and given it a theme and all that. There's a big Italian community around there anyway, but also got all the logistics sorted out. So yes, you know, the rubbish is taken away properly. It all looks clean. You know, there's good water facilities, and that's what you need, because people do notice that stuff.
Because Time Out have done a similar thing in Lisbon, and when they did their big IPO about 8 months ago or 10 months ago, their whole story was the rollout of the night market. That was literally their entire funding model for the future. And there was a rumour that it was due to come to London. I'm not sure when it's coming to London, but they're obviously betting heavily on this space. I mean, it's interesting, is it going to become corporatised? Is it going to lose its touch? You know, it's going to be interesting to sort of watch the space that evolves.
People love eating, though, in those sorts of places, don't they? Even though the menus are incredibly short, it just feels dynamic because you know it's changing.
But I think when the menu's short, you can do it really well.
Yeah.
And if you're a foodie, then you're going to be drawn to something because it is well done, as well as being interesting. There's nothing worse than going into one of these, you know, the classic kind of greasy spoon type places, even if it's not like your classic British style. They've got a menu that is 5 pages long, and you know that everything is going to be average, whereas if you've got a menu with 3 or 4 items on it, you just instinctively assume that the higher concentration of effort going into fewer dishes is going to yield better results.
Absolutely. Well, we'll return to a little bit of that subject, but actually I'm much more interested in the ice cream later.
Absolutely.
Don't you think, with Lee? So we're just going to listen to this pre-record. We held the Food Talk Awards on Monday. It was incredible. So we just got a bit of a...
We have just about recovered.
So we just got a little bit of a short record on that. And then we're going to come back and talk to Lee about his amazing alcoholic ice cream. Speak to you later.
Okay, so I'm at the Food Talk Awards. We've just had our main course. We're just waiting for dessert. And just before we had the main course, we heard from the winners of the All in the Taste Drink Award, who were Toast Ale. And I'm with them now.
Woo-hoo!
I've got 3 of them, big team. So could you, first of all, let me know your names?
David.
And David, what do you do at Toast Ale?
I am the customer happiness manager, and I'm the newest toaster on the team.
Well, good start. Winning an award.
It is, it's super exciting.
Hello, I'm Julie, and I am the production and sales manager for Toast Ale.
Lovely. And
hi, I'm Louisa. I look after marketing and finance. Yeah.
Lovely. So we've got the dream team here today, and how does it feel to win?
Amazing.
Brilliant.
Wow.
Thank you.
A really real big privilege. There's lots of amazing people here tonight, and it was a really nice opportunity to get to talk to lots of people, to get them to try our beer and hear the story of surplus fresh bread being turned into delicious beer, all profits to charity feedback, and amazingly to get them to vote for us at the end of the day.
Of course. Well, I mean, yeah, you do have an interesting product. It is Toast Ale. Which one of you wants to explain sort of a little bit about how the idea came about and how it works?
Over to David. Let's test the new boy.
Thanks. Well, the magic started with our founder, Tristram Stewart, who was drinking beer in Belgium. And he happened to be in a pub over there and drinking a beer brewed from bread. And the light bulbs went off in his head and thinking, gosh, what amazing way to raise awareness for the huge issue of food waste. So out of that was born Toast Ale. And the amazing team here have started the journey off in terms of brewing beer locally here in London with local brewers and bakers and translating into what we've got now is our flagship Toast Ale, Pale Ale, and more recently now a lager and IPA.
Well, of course, I mean, well, you've taken home the award as well. I mean, you had plenty of good competition. What do you think it is that sort of sets you aside from everyone else?
I think it's that we are a great message in a bottle. I mean, who doesn't love a great beer? And we talk about, actually, if you want to change the world, you've got to be having a better party than those that are destroying it. So by the power of great beer, we're getting people to think about the food that they buy, how they store it, use it, and how they shouldn't be wasting it. And I just think it's a very positive message. Basically, great beer that tastes as good as the good that it does. A bit clunky there, but I think Toast is a beer that does good and tastes good.
Well, it seems that everyone has agreed with you. I mean, what have you made of the night as a whole?
Yeah, it's been a great night. We've had met some great people, had some great food. Great drinks, of course.
Yeah. And we can't wait for dessert, which is coming up behind.
Yeah, well, I'll let you get back to that in just a minute. So what's next for Toast Ale? Obviously, you won the award tonight. I'm sure it's probably not your first, though. But what's next on the sort of Toast Ale agenda?
Well, we recently launched in the US. We've done a crowdfunding round to brew a American Pale Ale in New York. So they're busy brewing at the moment, hoping to be ready to release for Independence Day. We're also looking at expanding internationally more generally. So we've got South Africa launching later in the summer. And generally scaling up so we can tackle the global problem of food waste at a global level. All the profits going back into charity all over the world so that we can all play a part in tackling food waste. I'll let David also maybe say a little bit about some of the stuff we're doing in the UK. Loads of fantastic expansion in terms of our retailers as well.
Yeah, it's super exciting actually in that in the next couple of weeks we'll be selling our beer at Queen's Tennis. So we're ramping ourselves up for that, and we're really excited with that particular opportunity. And then equally, we've recently launched into Waitrose, so our pale ale is available there now nationally, which is again super exciting for us. So there's some of the big opportunities, but then there's lots of fantastic new stockists that we're been working with over the past year and currently coming online as well. So lots of really exciting opportunities.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations everyone, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you on the Food Talk show in the future.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
To you.
So I'm at the Food Talk Awards with Sarah Ward, and she has just won the All in the Taste Food Award with her company Boozy Udders. So Sarah, how happy are you?
I'm ecstatic. I'm also a bit flabbergasted, but really, it's lovely. It's a lovely event, and I'm really excited about it.
Of course, we've had some obviously fantastic competition. We've had lots of companies here showing off their food today. Can you tell me a little bit about what your product is?
Our product is called Boozy Udders, and it's alcoholic cocktail ice cream. So these are ice creams based on luxury, famous classic cocktails.
Lovely. I mean, they've clearly gone down well. You did get the most votes. Is there any others that you've seen here tonight that you thought?
So many of them. Actually, the quality is so high. I'm a big fan of Toast Ale myself. I know it anyway from a few months ago, and I think it's a fabulous product. I think there was the most wonderful, I can't remember the name of it, but the wonderful chicken pâtés and
Jamaica,
yes. That was superb. I didn't even get round to tasting half of them, I'm afraid. I didn't taste the lovely chocolates, but a couple of them stood out.
Lovely, of course. Well, obviously brilliant, as you got to the final anyway and then won it. What have you thought of the evening as a whole?
It's been really just so full of passionate people who are so excited by food or great produce, great drinks, great food, and the quality is so high. I think what comes to the fore, what's important to me is the quality of ingredients sings through, and you know that you are tasting the best of the best by people who really love doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen, obviously, the reason why we're hosting these awards is because of, like, the boom in food tech. Do you see that sort of still carrying on, that trend of sort of amazing food products?
I really think it will. And sometimes I think, what's next? There cannot be anything else that's about to come to the fore or make people excited. And then something else does. I think we have to take our inspiration from some of the really great food producers who use really natural products, who use fresh products as much as possible, and you can tell in the result.
Absolutely. I mean, you've won a Food Talk Award tonight. Where's Boozy Others going to go in the future?
Ooh, well, we are in a transitional stage where we are now moving to the next level. So far we've been working closely with farm shops, delis, a few restaurants, one or two sort of specialist places where they've taken our small pots for cinemas, that kind of thing. Now we want to move to the next level and approach possibly one or two major retail supermarkets. We'll see.
Is this the first award that you've won?
It's not the first. But it's the most exciting, of course.
Of course. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing lots more from you on the Food Talk Show in the future. But where can people sort of find out more about Boozy Uzzle?
Well, if you go to our website, we're on Twitter, Facebook, but probably our website will tell you the most in-depth information about what we do and where we are stocked and what our ethics are and how we sort of, take the product forward. So.
Well, fantastic, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm at the Food Talk Awards with Sarah and Adam, and I'm with the company Be Tempted, and sat on the table in front of me are some flourless brownies and a big shiny award, because they were the winners on the Free From category. So, Sarah, Adam, how glad are you that you've won?
So thrilled that we won. This is an amazing award to receive tonight. We're up against fierce competition, and I was so happy to go up on stage when they announced our name.
And obviously, I can't remember, it was something that the judge said, absolutely lovely, can I have another one or something?
I think she said something like, shut the door,
yes,
something along those lines. I really want to get the exact phrase that she used, because I thought that was phenomenal. We want to use that in our marketing.
Absolutely. So can you just tell me a little bit about Be Tempted, the company, and just sort of the journey and the story and sort of how you've come to be here?
Sure. So I started Be Tempted from my home kitchen. I started baking brownies and cakes for my flatmates and then friends and family, and I just took off, started selling to Whole Foods, Harrods, Fortnum's and Selfridges. And 12 months ago we set up a dedicated gluten-free site in East London, and 3 months ago I brought on Adam, who is our chief visionary officer, and he's helping make the company as efficient as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously the award that you've won is the Free From Awards, and obviously the reason why the Food Talk Award, why we've done a Free From Pioneer Award, is because there is so much great stuff out there. Sort of, do you think that it can only go sort of get better? The competition's only going to get more fierce, do you reckon?
I think it's a really interesting category, and I think certainly, like Sarah was saying, the competition was quite fierce. So we're really proud of what we've done and achieved here. There's a great team behind Be Tempted. We call ourselves the Be Tempted family because it really is like that. We are a big family, and all the work that goes into this, I mean, it's great, and I think everyone is just as pleased as we are to receive the award. It's an interesting category. There's a lot of people that are kind of moving into this category, so to be winners in this, I think, is great.
What do you think it is that set you aside from the rest?
Ooh, I think it's the quality of our ingredients that really make the finished product phenomenal. So we use Belgian chocolate, we use French butter, and we use amazing ground almonds, and it's the process that we go through to make the product taste as good as it does.
I suppose it's one of those things, because I tried some when it came into the office, thank you. It's one of those things when you think Free From, I think in the past people have thought, it's going to be better for you, but the taste might not be there. So I guess that's something that you've had to work very hard on, obviously, to get that taste exactly where you want it.
Absolutely. So when I started the business and I started doing in-store samplings at some of our stores, our customer stores, the reaction that we had initially was people didn't want to taste the product because there was a stigma attached with Free From being bland, boring, tasting like cardboard, and people just didn't want to taste it. So there was a lot of education that we needed to tell customers, and we had to break through this immense stigma. But now it seems to be this category which we've managed to, you know, help create, and more people are coming into it, and the Free From market is just exploding. So it really does show that we are onto something good.
Well, clearly the award is sat in front of me. What have you made of the night as a whole?
I've loved it.
It's been fantastic. Yeah, interesting to meet so many amazing people in the industry. The food industry at the moment is just an explosion of tastes and flavours, and there's been some great winners here tonight, and it's been great to come and meet them as well, to taste some of the products that have been out there. It's been a thoroughly enjoyable evening.
Well, I'll let you get back to your wine in just a sec. What does the future hold for Be Tempted?
We have some really exciting things coming up. We're bound by a few confidentiality agreements. Okay. So can't really say. We are talking to a big supermarket, though, and we are going to be on a national television show in a couple of months' time.
So very exciting.
This space.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure we're hearing more from you on the Food Talk Awards. We've had a quick catch-up now. But where can people find out more about the company?
www.be-tempted.co.uk, and also on Twitter at BeTemptedHQ.
Brilliant. Well, you haven't had too much wine then. You managed to remember that one. Thank you very much, guys, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
That was really good, wasn't it? So let's forget about that, because in front of me I have four tubs of ice cream. I'm going to
tell you what they are.
They're really small. We're going to eat them before we speak to Lee, because obviously they're going to melt and it's really, really hot in this studio. I have chocolate espresso martini. Ice cream. I've got mojito in front of you there.
That looks good,
doesn't it? We've got strawberry daiquiri.
And I've got a toffee and vodka.
Toffee and vodka. So I'm going to tuck into a little bit of chocolate espresso martini.
I'm going to go toffee.
You're going to go.
And then we'll pass them round.
Pass them round. Okay. So let's have a. And these are genuinely, Lee, you have to tell me, these are genuinely alcoholic, aren't they?
Yep. So they've all got an alcoholic percentage. So if you have enough of them, you'll definitely feel something.
I can't drive after this then.
No, you can. Yeah. It's not that extreme. I think the one you're tasting now is a chocolate espresso martini. That's only 3.5%. So.
And the mojito?
4.5. Toffee vodka is the strongest one, so that's 6.51%.
Oh, wow, I can feel it already. It's got
so
a
that's
really.
The equivalent of having lager, isn't it?
It's
a very strong lager.
Yeah, so you've got
a very strong ice cream.
You've got the equivalent.
One mouthful of lager, though.
Yeah, okay, but he might eat the whole. You know what he's like? He eats everything, so he probably eat the whole tub.
That toffee is really good. It's got a very kind of dark caramel flavour to it.
Yeah, it's
like almost like a caramel brittle kind of thing.
No, you're right. We use a brand called Thunder in our toffee and vodka, so it's a premium spirit drink that's sort of sold in like Harrods and Selfridges and things like that.
Oh, the mojito is very refreshing. I could definitely eat all of that.
Toffee one's a bit too sweet for me, but you know what I'm like. I really like. What are you saying, Ollie? Come
I'm
on,
Ollie's just kind of.
You're liking the martini.
Yeah, he's nodding and
Isn't
smiling
that good?
And pointing.
No, it's good. I haven't tasted my mojito. Sorry, he's trying to honk the whole thing himself.
Is that the mojito?
So while I'm tucking into the mojito,
that espresso martini is excellent, isn't it? It's like creamy and rich and all sorts of good things.
Now, just explain to me, Lee, how on earth did you? I mean, I know you're a Nick studied psychology. I don't know what you studied. Nick has had some interesting jobs, it says here. According to his LinkedIn.
They're all very showbiz.
It says that Nick used to be road manager to David Hasselhoff. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I used to work in entertainment myself, working for various high-profile individuals. I met Nick along the way. He worked for David for around about 6 years. I worked with Nick and David while they're in the UK. Me and Nick become really good friends. And then it was November 2015. We sort of sat down and sort of both
said we don't want to work with the Hoff no more. We're going to make ice cream. Is what you said.
Yeah,
makes perfect sense.
We'd built sort of a good network of contacts and relationships, and thought we were in such a good position, lucky position to actually give something a real good shot. And we both drink far too much, so we knew it was going to be something alcohol based. And then we just sort of sat down and come up with the idea of ice cream and alcohol and put them both together.
And when you say alcohol based, you're almost doing it a disservice, because the website and all of your materials that you've brought into the studio today describe it as the most alcoholic ice cream in the world.
Correct, yes, that is true. So
It's like really taking it to extremes, which is absolutely fantastic. We love a bit of that.
Mm. So we've got here luxury alcoholic ice cream. I've got the most beautifully produced brochure in front of me. I mean, it looks like, I don't know, the brochure of a multinational, you know, PLC or something, doesn't it? It's
I don't think theirs are usually that nice.
It's more like a Tesla.
Yeah, absolutely. And you,
it looks
got,
very high tech.
It's really, I mean, it's really beautiful. And you obviously know what you're doing in terms of marketing your stuff here. Creating this brand, this feeling of luxury, is that what has managed, as long as having an amazing product, to get you into things like Selfridges and be upmarket?
Yeah, I think so, because people will look at a brand before even attempting to taste something. Federico, who's our brand director, is so good at what he does. He's got such good vision, and sort of how he does things and creates things is beyond amazing. But yeah, it also, I think, does help because people have never heard of alcoholic ice cream before. So when you've got something that looks really nice and then something people have never heard of, they've automatically got this urge to try it or obviously buy it as well. So it's really interesting.
Because apparently the ice cream industry in general hasn't been seeing a huge amount of growth recently, but this particular kind of segment of it is really the only ones that are growing. Like luxury ice cream and alcoholic ice cream are doing really, really well at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, no, definitely. In terms of our ice cream, just as classing it as an ice cream, it's all full dairy, so we don't use any water, where most ice creams tend to use water, and we use 0% air. So when you look at a gelato, that's sort of around about 60% air, and we use zero. So we've even sort of topped that as a sort of a luxury ice cream. So
it's funny, I would not normally have seen air on an ingredients list for ice cream, but I guess it's just to whip it to get some lightness into it.
Exactly. If you sort of pick up one of our pots compared to anyone else's, you'll notice that ours are a lot heavier, even though it's still the same amount, so it's 120 mil, and you can really tell the difference.
It's refreshing, so definitely,
but really it's good. Sort of why it makes it so creamy and sort of a good product to eat. But yeah.
Well, we've got some stats here, and the stats say that while dessert and alcohol-flavoured ice creams have been at the forefront of new product development in the UK market, 43% of Brits, so that's nearly half the population, claim they have not tried alcoholic-flavoured ice cream and would be interested in doing so.
Yep, sounds...
You need to convert those other half. They haven't even tried it yet, but they
need
trying.
To. Yeah, I think, again, it's from... like when we're talking to different stockists and even just general members of the public, and you sort of spring it on them that an alcoholic ice cream exists, they're automatically taken back and in shock. And then once they actually try it, they're blown away to the fact it is an ice cream, but you can still tell there's alcohol in there. It's not overpowering in any way, as you've all tried, and it's something that you could eat sort of a lot of.
It's one of those things I was just going to say, you call it a no-brainer. We don't really like that term around here, but the idea of putting ice cream and booze, which are two things that separately people tend to like, you don't have to sell them too hard, put them together and you've got something brand new, which is, you know, just as successful, if not more so.
Yeah, no, definitely.
But I also think there's kind of, you know, there's so much innovation in sort of ready meals and stuff. But actually, if you take the sort of the dessert moment, you know, stuff that people like Goo have done is incredible. And actually, I think there's some really interesting stuff going on in the ice cream world nowadays. Take brands like Jude's, you know, yourselves. There are lots of little brands who are kind of going, you know what, let's do this a bit different. Let's challenge the Ben and Jerry's of this world and start to actually create differentiated products, because so much stuff has become really, really similar, I think, in the ice cream world. And people are looking for interesting, fun desserts. As a nation, we eat loads of sweet stuff at the end of meals. And so I think this is kind of, you know.
But Ben and Jerry's did disrupt the market at the time, didn't they? Really? And now they've been taken on corporately. They just don't really. But they need to now innovate again, don't they, now they've been bought out?
Well, yeah. I mean, Ben and Jerry's were out, I think, on, you know, back in 2000.
Ages ago.
Years ago by Unilever. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, Unilever bought another ice cream brand in America the other day, which is a really, really high quality, bespoke, small business that I think they're rolling out around the world. There's lots of that kind of stuff. But what's nice is that you sort of want something. I think what foodies really like is the ability to discover an artisanal brand they haven't heard of before, and they can introduce it to their friends. So I think when there's a brand with a story that you can sort of say, hey, as you're saying yourself, you know, here's an ice cream brand with alcohol in it, that's an exciting message, and it's the kind of thing that you want to kind of share at the end of a dinner party or when you're out and about and doing stuff. So are you guys mainly focusing on the sort of out-of-home eating occasion, or are you also targeting more of the in-home?
I think a bit of both, to be honest. ice cream.
Is this the only pack size you have?
Yeah.
You have the
So I think for what it is, it's an easy treat to enjoy wherever you are. And again, ice cream's on every dessert menu across the world. So we're not looking at this as just a summer product. We want it to be all year round. But yeah, sort of the people that we're talking to in terms of Selfridges and then more to the sort of bars that we're stocked in, like Kensington Roof Gardens and Hippodrome Casino, it's not just something that you can consume at home. You can actually have it and enjoy it while standing at a bar or in a restaurant. And yeah, it's just giving people something different. Like
standing at a bar eating ice cream, that's an interesting concept. Do you think people
Well, you wouldn't
that?
Need to because there's plenty of booze in the ice cream.
No, but I mean the fact that you could go for a drink and whatever, it's late at night, it's really hot, and actually could order this because it is finger food. You can eat it, very easily.
But we have a lovely ice cream shop called Adelicious on Upper Street near our home. And if you go drive past Adelicious on a sort of 10:30 on a Saturday night, there's a queue outside. You go to Jalupo in Soho, it closes at midnight on a Saturday. And
that's unbelievable.
But I have to say, if my wife and I, if we're in Soho, we will probably avoid dessert wherever we are and we'll go to Jalupo in order to have their chocolate bonnet ice cream. And it's sort of, it's a really nice end of the meal and it's like going to a bar. So I'm not sure I'd see people in that occasion sort of eating ice cream at a bar, but I think there are so many moments where the ice cream offering is really boring. Take the theatre where it's
absolutely dreadful.
This actually really aligns quite well with the theatre.
And yet somebody's paying, let's say, £100 sometimes for a theatre ticket and then you're eating Woolsey's or something.
Loads.
This would be brilliant for a theatre because it's that same size pot. It's like 120ml, single serving. And instead of going out and with all the hustle and bustle in the bar at the interval, grab one of these and you're having a drink and your ice cream at the same time.
Also, you're not rustling. When people open a packet of crisps in the theatre, I just smack them one. They're not going to.
You have zero tolerance, Sue. That's what we love about you.
That is true. but Ollie, don't laugh at me. It's true. It's the most selfish thing to do.
It's very selfish to go
to theatre and you've got an amazing actor there. Judy Dench is there or something like that. And then somebody's eating a packet of cheese and onion.
Mobile phone going off is worse for me. But
cheese
anyway.
And onion going on.
I wanted to talk just quickly about, I don't know how much you can reveal about the secret recipe. But in my experience, putting a bottle of vodka or something like that in the freezer is great because it chills it right down. It becomes this kind of thick, syrupy consistency, but it never freezes. And yet you've combined vodka and all sorts of other spirits with ice cream and got it to freeze.
Yeah, there's
how do you do it?
Yeah, I'm not the chef. So Charlie, who's our chef that is also one of the founders, as far as I'm aware, it's a special technique. So even though we started in my tiny little flat in West London and we've now sort of moved to a factory in Somerset, I know of the process, but the technicalities of the process is something that I'm still not fully aware of. So
he probably doesn't want you to know. Lee.
Yeah, I think so.
Designed this way so that nobody knows apart from the super chef.
But yeah, we've sort of pushed the alcohol to its extreme to before it basically turns into a drink. So they still freeze really, really well, like an ice cream, and it still is an ice cream. It's just got such a limit of alcohol that it doesn't actually collapse.
So when you say turn into a drink, you mean as in stability wise?
Yeah, no, correct. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's still edible as an ice cream.
No, it's lovely. And you've managed to, in a very short time, to get yourself some pretty decent exposure on the radio and television, haven't you?
Yeah, no, definitely.
So I guess probably one of your most famous appearances is on This Morning with Holly and Philip. And Bradley Walsh as well.
Yeah, actually. So it was just before Christmas, and ITV every year have their own sort of Christmas market. So we were invited to go on. We were sort of amongst various street food vendors, and they sort of interviewed us one by one. And yeah, the response was absolutely insane. And at the time, we actually had an online shop, which was delivering to London only. And we went from doing around about 100 sales a day to that day we'd done about 2,000. Sales. So yeah, no, we all freaked out.
And that's how you scale up.
Yeah, no, exactly. But we only launched in October. Still a really new company. Oh, so wow. This was only 2 months after us launching, and it was insane. But it sort of just shows that people are so intrigued in wanting to try something new, and being able to have it accessible to them. It's sort of it's a no-brainer from their part. Yeah. So.
I think it also shows that what a lot of these, because we meet some really interesting small producers on this show and, in our daily lives, and a lot of them are, not that they're struggling, but, it always feels like they've got a great thing, but no one's heard of them. Mm. And so that idea of, you know, if you can get some prime time press and PR, then things can explode if you've got the right combination of people and product and all that kind of thing. It's really hard to get that kind of attention for all these small people, isn't it?
But then it comes down to distribution. And I think the greatest difficulty, I think, in the distribution thing is that, you know, you are in the worst part of the supermarket, which is the freezer world. Mm. And it's just this dead world where I think retailers have always struggled with. So I think if you're going to bring some excitement to that category, actually, I think retailers could be really excited by that, because there's been so much, you know, I know people like Iceland are trying to reinvent what frozen is all about, but I think that, you know, if you can bring some innovation to the world of frozen, I think that would be really interesting.
But Iceland, you know, that doesn't do it for me. I know it serves a purpose, and I know they do really, really well, but if you get Kerry Katona to advertise your stuff, then it's not going to work for me.
Do you know what I say?
This is the opposite end of
that. No, but it's interesting. I think the frozen world is misunderstood. Mm. And actually, if you take what you can do with frozen in terms of a lot of cod that ends up on a fish, supermarket fish counter is frozen before they make it fresh. Mm. And actually, the best thing you can do with some of this produce is freeze immediately at point of canning.
I'm okay with fresh food being frozen. Peas are better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they have to be frozen if you're on these huge trawlers. You know, I've got no problems with that at all, because it's just fresh food. What I struggle with is the family lasagna for four people. That's $1.99.
That's
what
just
is
not
in
for
it?
You. That's not
what
for
is
you.
In it?
No, you don't want
to. I know it's not
that
me.
Rule of thirds again,
I
isn't
it's not
it?
For me.
You know, it's marketed at that.
But
bottom.
It is. But if I am a foodie, it is overcoming that perception of the freezer aisle that you're saying, isn't
yeah.
it? And when you've got a beautiful brand like this, you're trying to sort of buck that category norm, aren't you? Or that category sort of perception.
And it's interesting, Love Food, Hate Waste, too, you know, it's the big campaign to try and reduce the amount of waste in the UK. They do a lot of saying, let's focus on the freezer and how much is there that we can do with our freezer. And I think it is one of those things that if you are buying, you know, doing a weekly shop still, you end up wasting a certain amount. If you actually use your freezer smartly, actually you reduce that.
No, I didn't know you could freeze bananas, you see.
Don't freeze them with the skin on.
Do you know? That's interesting.
And it's learning. It's actually learning stuff like that, isn't it? And understanding it.
So, yeah, we had some frozen bananas with skins on this week. And I have to say, taking the skin off was quite complicated.
Well, that
too. You're supposed to take it off first.
Yes, well, my 18-month-old didn't tell me that.
Well, I like to chop them up first, put them in a Ziploc bag, put them in the freezer. And then they're great in a smoothie. You just chuck them in instead of ice cubes. Mm. Fantastic.
Well, moving on back to you. Sorry, Lee.
We got a bit carried away. It was interesting.
So for you, we're talking about the sort of the perception of freezer. You're having to make your own sort of little cabinets, aren't you, and display things, because if you are going to get them into theatres and they're going to have their own, you know, dispenser, aren't they?
Yeah, no, I think point of sale is so important for any brand, but especially ours, because people have never heard of it. So to be able to explain to them what they're going to get for their money is a challenge, but as well as something that needs to be apparent. Freezers with branding and various different other like point of sale materials, it's so important for just brand awareness alone. So.
And I guess you've got to be very clear that it's got alcohol in it, and so the kids who go, oh, can I have an ice cream? You want to make sure that then, you know, the parents aren't going, oh yeah, sure, have an ice cream to shut them up.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think that's why one of the main reasons why people sort of look into stockers behind bars and things like that straight away. It's an automatic reaction for people to be asked for ID anyway. Our packaging as well, it's very luxurious, very slick, very adult. It doesn't have pictures of cows or bright colours. So it does sort of target the adult market.
And when I look at your marketing here, it seems that you're very clear in you know, your sort of segment, which looks like professional, late 20s, early 30s, you know, metro people going out and for the evening in a city somewhere. Is that how I got that? That's what it looks like.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think when we first sort of come up with the ice cream recipe, we straight away went to the extreme and used the best ingredients and the best of everything. So when we tried to do it with sort of terrible ingredients, it just wasn't the same at all. So as we were trying to sell a product that was luxury, we then thought, okay, we need to sell it as a luxury. But I think we've sort of made it an affordable luxury. So it's not something that, it's not an ice cream that's going to cost you £10. It's something that's available to everyone and gives everyone that sort of insight as to, well, this is actually an amazing exclusive product.
So if I could just describe this picture in your brochure, you've got a very, very, very handsome young couple. Obviously,
looks like one of those beautiful boys you mentioned.
Well, we don't look like you two, that's for sure. But when you look at it, they're in a private plane.
Yes.
They're in a private jet eating your ice cream in their designer clothes. And that's what we're going for. So you two, don't know why. They've both got beards though, so that's good.
There's a bit of similarity there.
But it is about being really clear, you know, what the brand identity is, and you've clearly got some good marketing people on board, haven't you? Because are going to go for the luxury end, you've got to look the part.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think perception and sort of image is everything for a brand. And as I said before, people aren't going to buy it based on the taste because they wouldn't have tasted it beforehand. So for something to look good enough for someone to part with their money, it's so important.
But I also think there's been a lot of chat about the fact that people don't want high impact, kind of like I call them old fashioned type cocktails nowadays when they're in a bar. And then amongst the younger generation, there is a growth in things like, you know, not drinking less frequently, veganism, eating less meat, eating less fish. So I actually think this is playing into a sort of cultural change here, which is that younger people are more interested in slightly lighter. I mean, while there is alcohol in them, this is not an old fashioned, in terms of, you know, proper cocktail
kicks like
a meal. Exactly. This is kind of light alcohol. It's alcohol, but it's done in a sort of soft way.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's just a different offering that doesn't exist already. So it sort of gives people that opportunity to not have to have a drink. I was
desperately trying to find a photograph, which I couldn't find, which is I was reminded of when you were talking about the need to create cabinets and things, that when I was in the Peak District last summer, I saw a special stand, which was a freezer, which was designed, it was yogurts for dogs.
Exactly. You have to be joking.
I'll have to find it. So literally, they had these. It was about the same size thing. And obviously, the idea is you turn out your little thing and then the dog could eat it on a hot day in the Peak District. You need a hot day in the
Peak District in the same sentence.
Yogurt. Exactly. It's like none of this makes any sense. I'm worried as I flicked through my photos that I couldn't find it. I'm wondering that maybe I dreamed this whole thing. But maybe we need to find the people who do this and bring them on the show.
A few years ago, I came across a beer for dogs as well. It was kind of crazy, but...
Okay. Oh, well, we wish you all the luck in the
thank
world
you so
with
much.
This. Where is it available at the moment?
So at the moment, we're in Selfridges, we're in Bounce Ping Pong, which is based in London, Hipstone Casino, Kensington Roof Gardens, and also in Heathrow VIP, which is a lounge at Heathrow Airport.
VIP, of course.
But
people can go onto your website, can't they, if they want to find out
definitely.
More?
So cheersicecream.co.uk, and then social media is at cheersicecream.
Cheers, ice cream. Well, my favourite, I would say, I did like the mojito. Actually, very refreshing.
Martini.
I like the strawberry daiquiri. I don't know what that says about me.
Slightly
but
sweet. Slightly sweet and fruity. Yeah. That's what it says
a bit
about
fruity.
You.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
thank
brilliant.
You,
as usual, everything we have is on the foodtalk.co.uk website. Thank you very much to Guy Routledge, as usual, Food Rush, for joining me, and to Ollie Lloyd, great British chefs. And we very much look forward to talking to you next week. We'll be playing some more next week from the Food Talk Awards, which were incredible.
We're trying to milk it as much as possible.
We are trying
to
milk it as much as possible. So, we look forward to seeing you next week. And don't forget, all of these are available as podcasts. Okay, then. See you next week. Definitely.